Feature talk.
Free audio archives, free downloadable MP3s of past shows, and much more at FutureTalkRadio.com.
And now, Future Talk with Zohara Hieronymus.
Future Talk, I'm Zohara Hieronymus, and joining us today is Michael Cremo. He has joined us in the past for a number of his books, which include Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, and The Hidden History of the Human Race. And what we're going to do today is, Michael's joined us because some of you may be aware there are some cases that come up now and then, the difference between creationism and evolutionism, and whether or not there's intelligent design, I guess, is the newest way to articulate, which is held as a treasured understanding by millions, if not billions, of people on Earth, and yet still the Darwinian theory of evolution seems to hold sway as a political tool of education. And we're going to discuss that and much more with a gentleman who is really world-recognized as an authority on archaeological anomalies. He lectures extensively worldwide. He's headed off for some tours of Japan and Africa, Portugal, even our dear Maryland. And Michael, always a pleasure to spend time with you.
Great to be with you again, Zohara, and all your listeners.
Well, thank you so much. Well, look, we were last together a couple of years ago, and we took a straight-on look at your work, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. Maybe we can start there. If you could sort of give us the big picture of these two camps or way of looking at the world.
Well, I called my book Human Devolution a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory, but even though I called it a Vedic alternative based on ancient India's Sanskrit writings, I realize that the Vedic alternative is part of a larger spiritual family of alternatives to Darwinism, with roots in all the world's great spiritual traditions, which I deeply honor and respect. So I'm not taking a sectarian or position where I'm saying only I have the truth and nobody else does. But I think what we do have is, on the one side, we have the Darwinists, who are proposing that life as we know it, including human life, is the process of a purely materialistic process of evolution that began on Earth a couple of billion years ago, when chemicals, you know, combined to form the first living thing. And after, you know, those chemicals combined to form that first living thing, they say that first living thing began to reproduce and modify until, you know, billions of years later, you have human beings walking around. On the other side, we have the spiritual traditions, which hold that the various forms of life were designed, that they're not just combinations of chemicals, that they are vehicles for conscious selves, souls, and that these vehicles or bodies were designed by a supreme intelligent being for the purpose of giving souls or conscious beings a way to exist in the material world, and also to make progress in going back to their real home, the spiritual world. Now, in the middle, between these two camps, you have some who are trying to straddle the fence, which, and not very successfully, in my opinion. These would be people who would say, yes, there is an intelligent designer, there is a God, there is a supreme being, but he created the forms of the living things by evolution. And there are a couple of problems I see with that position. One is, God never said he did it that way. If you look at any of the great scriptures of the world, the Bible, the Quran, the Vedic literature, the traditions of tribal peoples throughout the world, you'll never see that God said he did it that way. And plus, there's a lot of scientific evidence that contradicts, you know, the Darwinian theory of evolution. So I think those in that middle camp who are trying to straddle the fence, so to speak, are in a very uncomfortable position. And I'm very much in favor of the position that a supreme intelligent being, an intelligent designer, designed the bodies of living things in the beginning as vehicles for souls.
Well, and I think one of the, as I recall in one of our discussions, you likened it to our being more like fallen angels than, you know, evolving apes. And having studied, as I have, so many perennial wisdom teachings, there's no doubt in my mind, and yet there is so much doubt and rancor in other peoples that they somehow or other have come to associate intelligent design with merely Christianity, and therefore to discuss a scientific perspective different than evolutionism is somehow or other an assertion of a particular religion. And I just see that there's no validity in that. And yet that's what this court case is about in Pennsylvania. And we're speaking in the early part of 2006. Maybe it'll be resolved by the time this airs. But tell us a little bit about that, because this won't be the first time that there's this big rancor over even such a short thing as a four-paragraph statement being read to students about, hey, look, you know, there's another perspective other than Darwin.
Well, the case that you're talking about, the Pennsylvania one, has in fact been resolved as we're speaking. A couple of weeks ago, the federal district court judge in that case ruled in favor of the evolutionist who had been opposing the introduction of alternatives in the education system. So I think that you're right that many people, including federal district court judges, think that when intelligent design is brought up, it's just covered Christianity,
mm-hmm.
Fundamentalist Christianity. And I think that shows an incredible lack of knowledge about this position, which is held by people of many different faiths. For example, although I have a great deal of respect for Christianity in all of its forms, I myself have chosen another path, which has its roots in Hinduism, you know, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, and those of us who follow that path also believe in an intelligent designer who has designed this world, who has designed the living forms in it. And we think there's an incredible amount of evidence for that, in addition to the evidence that's there in the scriptures as well. It's also a position that's held by Islamic people. There are Islamic people who accept an intelligent designer and creator. There are people from Native American traditions, Australian.
Well, and do you think that, Michael, some of it comes down to either you believe in a spiritual body of wisdom that applies to our spiritual beingness, or you only believe in the mechanical sciences? But even then, and maybe we should turn our attention to a moment, because I think where your work and when you've worked with others, just a remarkable display of scientific evidence that, no, folks, we didn't evolve from apes. So let's take a little bit of time while we have a chunk of it to address some of the scientific evidence. If someone in the audience is going, well, you know, I don't think I have a soul either, and I don't believe that I'm evolving, and I don't think that we're headed back to spiritual beingness, and I don't think, you know, Earth is a classroom. Let's talk about what you have found, as you actually did, I guess one could call it, the archaeology of archaeology.
Yes, well, this goes back to my book, Forbidden Archaeology, which presents archaeological evidence that contradicts the Darwinian theory of human evolution. Because that's what most people are interested in. I think that's what the debate is really about,
mm-hmm.
human beings. Other forms of life are also interesting, but even many Darwinists say that the evolution of humans is their best case, you know, for evolution. So I thought, well, let me look at their so-called best case, and let's see the evidence for it. Now, what they want to say is that human beings of our type, anatomically modern human beings, came into existence between 1 and 200,000 years ago, and before that, there were only more primitive ape-like ancestors of human beings, like Homo erectus, Homo habilis, and Australopithecus, and others like that. And before that, there were only very primitive apes and monkeys. And before that, only some primitive mammals. And before that, reptiles. And before that, amphibians. And before that, you know, just tiny one-celled, you know, creatures living in the ocean. So that is the version that is taught in most of the schools now. That's the version you see in the textbooks. And When you look in the textbooks, you see only the evidence that goes along with that idea. So most people think, well, here's the evidence, here's what they say, they match up, and so the evolution theory must be true. The problem is most people aren't seeing all of the evidence. There's a lot of evidence that contradicts that picture of human origins, but it's not very well known because of what I call a process of knowledge filtration. You know, the reports of evidence that go along with the Darwinian theory, you'll see in the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
The reports of evidence that don't go along with it, you don't see them in the textbook. So what I tried to do is collect all those reports, put them together in a book so that people could see what the total evidence is. And I think when people see the total evidence, then they'll be willing to raise some questions about what they're now being told. And this evidence that I gathered together in Forbidden Archaeology consists of reports of anatomically modern human skeletons, anatomically modern human footprints, and artifacts of the kind that archaeologists normally attribute to human beings like us that go back millions of years.
And as I recall, those balls were like 2 billion years old?
Well, yes, there were some round metallic objects that have been found by miners in South Africa. They are 2 or 3 inches in diameter. The most interesting feature is the parallel grooves mm-hmm. that go around the center of each object. And the objects are made of a kind of iron called hematite. And these parallel grooves are very, very interesting, and metallurgists who have examined them say that they cannot explain how they could have formed naturally within the layers of the earth, which means they had to have been put on these objects by beings with some human intelligence.
And of course, I suspect
layers of rock that go back 2 billion years.
Well, and I was going to say, and I suspect there's some people on a far edge of everything who would say, well, you know, maybe it's extraplanetary intervention or visitation. But I want to step back for a moment because it boggles the mind that such a simple issue as introducing to students an opportunity to consider some of these facts and that these facts would support another alternative to evolution is so disconcerting. So I want to return to your mention of the knowledge filter. What are they so afraid of?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons, but fundamentally I think it has to do with power. You know, there are various kinds of power in this world. You know, there's political power, mm-hmm. there's military power, there's economic power. There's also intellectual power. It's a very subtle power, but a very real one. And those who possess it, have the ability to set a direction, you know, for a nation, for a people, for actually our whole worldwide human civilization.
Or if I can interrupt you for a second, or tenure for professors in lineages of journals. Well, look, we're going to take a little break and then we'll be right back. I'm Zohara Hieronymus and you're listening to Future Talk.
What gets through our experience or through our perception is only what our values or ideas will let through.
Welcome to Future Talk. I'm Zohara Hieronymus, and online with us today is Michael Cremo, C-R-E-M-O. You can find him online. And Michael, which do you prefer? There are a number of ways to find you online.
Well, people can go to my personal website, mcremo.com, M-C-R-E-M-O.com, and they can find everything about my work there. There are also some special websites.
I saw one for humandevolution.com and forbiddenarchaeology.com. But to be simple, folks, go to mcremo, C-R-E-M-O.com. Now, before the break, we were talking about, I asked you why so many scientists seem afraid of exploring what I consider the scientific facts, not just spiritual lineages, of intelligent design, and you were saying that there's all kinds of powers and that power is part of it. So can you continue on that?
Yes, Zohara. I think power is one of the reasons that they're resisting. We see that people who have power don't like to give it up very easily. For example, if one political party has a monopoly on the political life of the country, it doesn't want to give up its position. If one corporation, you know, has a monopoly in a certain sector of the economy, it doesn't want to give up its position. If one party within the scientific world has a monopoly in the education system and the scientific institutions, as the Darwinists now have, then I think it's natural they don't want to give up that position. I think it's natural that they will even use the agencies of the government, like the judicial system, to enforce their monopoly. But I think the American people are starting to wake up to that's not such a good idea.
And I think the vast numbers of people worldwide think it's ludicrous. So it really is a particular almost illness germane to Western education. So I want to come back again to this knowledge filter and sort of double standards that happen in the scientific community. I still want to just keep sort of pushing your button of power's one thing, but ideas are another. Are you saying that if we accept that there's intelligent design, then all of a sudden it makes us more responsible maybe for our conduct on Earth? Maybe people can't just sort of excuse their lives away.
Well, I think that's one thing. I think also the focus on matter keeps people very much involved in material production and consumption, and that generates a lot of wealth, and I think a lot of it flows into the pockets of the scientists who are inventing the drugs and the weapons and the consumer products, the corporations.
I see what you're saying.
Sell all over the world, and that gets them a lot of profits, and the governments get a lot of tax money from it.
Would you think another piece of it is if you don't believe in an eternal soul, that you have a lot of fear over holding onto everything you can get in the material world?
Yes, I think that's possible. So I think it is, on one level, an intellectual question, a scientific question that can be discussed, dispassionately,
and right,
just in terms of facts, are they right or wrong? But but rarely do we find that any human endeavor is free from various other kinds of motivations. And I think the motivations that underlie the extreme, almost fanatical resistance that scientists have, many scientists, I'm going to say many because not all of them are like that, but many of them have a very fanatical, fundamentalist type of resistance to alternatives to Darwinism that is very, very striking. And I think there's more to it than just the facts, whatever they may turn out
and,
to be.
And when you wrote Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, which was really a collation of all of the responses to your work, Forbidden Archaeology, what were the most prevalent ones, if you could put them into categories?
Well, there were a few reactions, because actually the scientific world is not monolithic. There were many, of course, who completely opposed what I was doing. They were very upset with me. They didn't want me to speak anywhere. They tried to block me from giving lectures at universities and appearing on television programs and things of that sort. But then there's another group who support the Darwinian theory, but are a little more open-minded and willing to consider alternatives. And I think they are the majority of scientists, actually. But those who are in the positions of power and decision-making tend to be of the very fundamentalist, Darwinist type. So you have this middle group who are very open-minded, and they've invited me to speak at many scientific conferences and scientific institutions around the world, such as the Royal Institution in London, the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow, other scientific institutions around the world. And they're willing to listen to alternatives, which I think is very important, because if ideas are going to change, the first thing is they have to be willing to listen. Then there's a third group, which actually agree with me. And they're small in number now. They're a minority within the scientific world.
Well, look, can you hold that thought? And when we come back, you can tell us a little bit more about the group who says, all right, not only do we agree with Michael Cremo that there's intelligent design, but this is why. And you're listening to Future Talk, so stay tuned for more.
Will is the spark of life, and it gives rise to a direction that we call idea or belief or a movement towards something.
Welcome to Future Talk. I'm Zohara Hieronymus, and online with us today is author Michael Cremo. Maybe some of you have seen some of his online discussions or had the privilege of being at some of his talks as he travels the world. But his books are numerous, and they are Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology, Forbidden Archaeology's Impact, and The Hidden History of the Human Race. We are looking at why it is that our humanity seems to have so much trouble, particularly in the Western educational system, to accept even the evidence that there is intelligent design and not just a Darwinian theory of evolution. So you were telling us, so of these three groups, there's a smaller group within the scientific community who says, yeah, we see intelligent design makes the most sense based, I guess one could say, on the evidence.
Yes, some of them have been victims of this knowledge filtering process themselves, and maybe that's why they're a little responsive to what I have to say. You know, for example, there's the case of Virginia Steen McIntyre, an American geologist I know, who early in her career was involved in dating an archaeological site down in Mexico, where some archaeologists had found human artifacts at a place called Huayatlaco near Puebla. And she and her colleagues dated this site. They were brought there by the archaeologists specifically to date the site. And Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues came up with an age of about 300,000 years for this particular site. The archaeologists refused to accept it. They said that's not possible. Human beings capable of making these artifacts didn't exist 300,000 years ago anywhere in the world, what to speak of North America. So Virginia Steen McIntyre was a little bit shocked. You know, she was just a geologist doing her job, and she just reported the evidence, and she didn't realize how deeply woven into the scientific mentality this theory of evolution is, such that evidence that contradicts it is going to be rejected simply because of that. She was very shocked and surprised, and it sort of opened her eyes to something. So many of the scientists who are, you know, supporting what I have to say are
themselves victims of the status quo.
Who have run into that knowledge filter.
And you're right. We see it in absolutely every spectrum of human endeavor. And this program has covered a great deal of this kind of suppression of information that really makes people independent. And I think for myself, when I look at the battle you've waged on behalf of the Almighty Creator and the fact that we are all part of this intelligent design and kind of re-arising into our awareness of it, is that there are a lot of people who I think seem to have trouble appreciating that we are multidimensional beings, and they'd like to think you're born and you die and that's it.
Well, I think you're right about that, which is why in the approach that I take, you know, I say before we even ask, you know, these questions like where did human beings come from and where did life come from and things like that, we should first of all ask what is a human being?
Mm-hmm. And what is the purpose of a human?
Yes, and I think that has to do a lot with the fact that most people just assume, you know, we're a combination of matter, that's all we are, and therefore, you know, what's to think about. I think if we actually look at all of the evidence that comes to us, you know, from science, we're going to see, you know, that a human being is much more than a combination of chemicals. I think there's scientific evidence for a mind element, a subtle mind element that can act in ways that we really can't explain, you know, by our current laws of physics that just deal with ordinary matter. You know, I think there's a lot of evidence for extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, you know, the ability of mind to move matter and things like that. And then beyond that, there's evidence for a conscious self that can exist completely apart from the body. I mean, that evidence comes from medical reports of out-of-body experiences, reincarnation memories, and things of that sort. So I think when we look at all of the evidence, we see that a human being is much more than a combination of chemicals. Chemicals are there. That's part of what a human being is. But beyond that, there's a subtle mind element. Beyond that, there's a conscious self. You can call it spirit if you like. And when we take it all into account, I think it becomes very clear that we didn't evolve up from matter. Rather, we devolved or came down from a level of pure consciousness or spirit.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take our last break, and then we'll come back, and maybe we'll talk specifically about our descent into matter, and as I like to think, our ascent back into spirit, and maybe we're at the bottom and on our ascent back up, and that's why things are becoming clearer to the public. Our guest is Michael Cremo, and you're listening to Future Talk. Welcome to Future Talk. I'm Zohara Hieronymus. Author Michael Cremo joins us, and some of you may have read some of his works. I want to point your attention to Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory, and it's a Torchlight release. You can go to www.mcremo.com and get links to all of his other work. So coming back then to the theory of devolution versus evolution, explain to us sort of in a nutshell what you've described in these volumes of work.
Well, I've described that we don't evolve up from matter, as we're now being told. Rather, we've devolved or come down from a level of the cosmos that is dominated by the element of pure consciousness or spirit. We were talking a little bit earlier about how there's a lot of scientific evidence that a human being is not just a combination of ordinary matter, but is a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness or spirit. And to me, that suggests that we live in a multi-level cosmos, where at each level a certain element dominates, and that level is inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions at that level. So now we find ourselves in the level of the gross material elements, and we find that level is inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. But beyond that, there is a level of the cosmos dominated by the subtle mental elements. And that level of the cosmos is also inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. And people have had different names for them down through the centuries. Angels, gods, goddesses, astral beings, subtle beings. And beyond that, however, there's another level of the cosmos, a level dominated by pure consciousness, spirit. And one thing we notice about consciousness, it's individual, it's personal. I have my consciousness, you have your consciousness, each of your listeners has his or her consciousness. So consciousness is individual and personal. And to me, that suggests that the source of all conscious being is also individual and personal. And you could say that's my roundabout way of getting to the idea of God as the source of all conscious beings. Now, it's possible for a conscious self to live forever in harmony with the supreme conscious being on that level. However, love, the founding principle of existence on that level, has to be voluntary. It has to be free. In other words, God is not going to force anyone to remain with him. That wouldn't be love if God forced us to remain on that level. So we have freedom. We have choice. And that freedom has to be able to be acted upon. If we couldn't act upon that freedom to choose, then what kind of freedom would it be?
It's like and what kind of development would there be of our free will?
Right.
To choose the right thing.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, like telling a person, well, you know, you're free to go, but when they go to the door, it's locked.
So
how free are they, you know, at that point? So we have to be able to exercise our free will, and God gives us the ability to do that. If we become attracted to the lower levels of energies, then we're free to enter into them, and we're free to exist on those levels with suitable vehicles for acting on those levels. And those vehicles or bodies are provided by God. So we begin on that level of pure consciousness or spirit, but if we decide to descend into these lower levels to seek our happiness there, we are given that opportunity. We're given a suitable vehicle to operate in these levels. Just like, say, if we normally operate on the land as human beings. If we want to survive under the water, we have to have a suitable vehicle, a submarine or something, or a diver's suit, to exist in a different element. So when we come from the level of pure consciousness or spirit down to these levels, we need a vehicle. We're given a vehicle designed, you know, by God for us, in the form of different bodies, plants, animals, human beings, others, gods, goddesses, astral beings, and we have the freedom to exist on whatever level we want. However, we notice on this level where we are now, it's not an entirely comfortable position. There's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of suffering, there's disease, death, old age. So the great wisdom traditions of the world have always recommended that through prayer, meditation, meditation, yoga, contemplation, or whatever, we should try to ascend. We should try to rise back to the level from which we started. And this is not something that's the property of any sectarian religion. This is the common spiritual heritage of humankind. And these processes of prayer and meditation and yoga and contemplation that are there in the great wisdom traditions of the world are sort of like the techniques that a geologist would use to extract gold, for example, from its ore, where it's mixed with other less valuable elements.
Well, and those all seem to invigorate the soul's presence in the body. And you mentioned love, which seems to be this discretionary option we have to either be selfish or selfless, you know, to contract and have fear or to be expansive and have love. But I want to jump ahead, if you don't mind, because we're almost out of time. So why now? I mean, here you've written this extraordinary book. I mean, I think it's the finest on the subject that the earth has yet in English. Why at this time period do you think such a person as yourself has been guided, obviously, through your love of God and the Bhagavad Gita and the whole tradition of Hinduism to write such a book?
Well, I don't think I'm alone. I think I'm a part of a whole, you know, group of people, of researchers and spiritualists and people who are moving in that direction. I think also the people like yourself who are, you know, making this knowledge available to people through the media are very important. So I think there are a lot of us who are moving mm-hmm. in this direction. I think we have a common impetus. You know, sometimes it's said that before the dawn it's the darkest mm-hmm. hour. So mm-hmm. maybe I
before
think
the day there's the night in Judaism, you know, and creation. Creation started at the night.
Right. So I think because our human civilization has reached a pretty low level
mm-hmm.
in terms of material
bottoming out.
Yeah, in terms of material progress, we could say, well, yeah, we've made a lot of progress. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got computers, but what do people use their computers for?
Right.
I mean, it's the biggest thing on the internet is pornography.
Right.
Yeah, we've made a lot of progress in medicine and science, but what are they using it for? To develop biological and chemical weapons and.
It's interesting because I've always sort of commented looking at it from a broad scale of world affairs is either we have a life economy or a death economy. And it's interesting when you're a materialist, you have a death economy. And when you believe in the soul, you tend towards giving the body to life. Anyway, we're going to take our last break of the hour and then we'll come back. Our guest, Michael Cremo, please find him. Go online, www.mcremo.com. Welcome to Future Talk. I'm Zohara Hieronymus. Don't forget, you can find all of our guests online at www.futuretalkradio.com. And to all of you who are fast becoming fans of our podcast, thank you. And do please use them a lot. And please visit our guest website at www.mcremo.com. And I think you will be so pleasantly engaged with the science of intelligent design. And I guess, Michael, that's, I think, the contribution you've made is you've really shown it's a science. And I was always wondering, and I don't know if I ever asked you, did you, with your faith in God, decide to look at the science to see what the science said about the creator? And that's where you found yourself in forbidden archaeology?
Well, yes. I mean, before, I became involved with the spiritual path, that I've chosen, I really didn't have any reason to question what I'd always been told in school and university by my teachers and professors. It was only when I got a spiritual perspective that I was able to step back. And sometimes you have to do that. You have to be able to step out of a situation
mm-hmm.
in order to see it clearly. So I think, yes, that was a big impetus for me. But sometimes people, they have this criticism where they say, well, you can't mix God and science and religion and science or whatever. But I look at myself as a human being looking for the truth. And whatever it is that helps me get to the truth, you can call it science, you can call it religion or whatever, then I'm going to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the problems that people have, even the people in our judiciary and the government and education systems, is they don't understand that God plays different roles in religion, philosophy, and science. Now, in terms of religion, that means we worship God, and everybody has their way of worshiping God, and I don't think the government should step in and tell people, you know, you can't worship God in this way or that way. I mean, assuming they're not, you know, committing criminal acts kind of the name. Similarly, in philosophy, philosophers have by logic and reason come to the conclusion that there's God. Many of them, not all of them, but a good many of them. So I don't think the government should be able to step in, you know, to a philosophy class and say to a philosophy student or a philosophy teacher or a philosopher, you can't come to the conclusion that there's God. That's I don't think the government has the right to do that. And similarly, in the world of science, some scientists, looking at the world, looking at the physical world, looking at the evidence that's there, have concluded there must be some kind of intelligent designer. And I don't think people should be shy about identifying the intelligent designer as a god. And I don't think the government has a right, you know, to step in and tell, you know, scientists that, or educators, that you can't come to that conclusion, that that's not part of science. So I think people are a little bit confused. If they properly understood the role that God plays in science, in religion, in philosophy, they wouldn't be objecting. Of course, you know.
Well, look, Michael, unfortunately, we're out of time. This moment, we'll be back another occasion with you, and I wish you all the luck in the world in your travels to Japan and Portugal and elsewhere. Go to www.mcremo.com, and thank you all for being with us on Future Talk. Future Talk is a production of Hieronymus & Company. Our executive producer is Megan Bowen, our show producer and webmaster, Nate Thompson. Visit us online at futuretalkradio.com, download free MP3s of past shows, and listen to any show you want. Visit our media center and our weekly blog. Make use of links to scientists, scholars, and organizations in the guest forum at futuretalkradio.com. And remember, imagine yourself richly, consider others' needs, and take part in shaping tomorrow by looking at the future today.